You're listening to episode 156 of Flick Fights, the official podcast of FlickChart.com. Hello, Flick Charters, and welcome to Flick Fights, the official Flick Chart podcast. I'm your host, Nathan Chase.
I'm Hannah Kiefer.
And I'm Doug Van Hollen.
And we're here to unravel all the various facets of film by pitting a series of two movies at a time in a fight to the death to see which is the better film and to find out which among them deserve to be considered one of the best movies of all time. If you're not familiar with FlickChart, head over to FlickChart.com, sign up for a free account, and get started on your very own chart. On this episode, we're going to be adding Solo, a Star Wars story, which is the latest side story anthology film with a troubled production to our chart. But before we do that, we've got some fights for you, so let's jump right in to the Thunderdome.
Two men, hand to hand. No jury, no appeal, no parole. Two men enter, one man leaves.
Weapons?
Anything is possible. Chance decides.
Thunderdome. How do I get in there?
That's easy. Pick a fight.
First up, we've got young Frankenstein up against There's Something About Mary. So Young Frankenstein is the Mel Brooks film from 1974, all in black and white and made to parody the early Universal monster movie films stars Gene Wilder as Victor Frankenstein or Frankenstein, as you may pronounce it. There's also There's Something About Mary, which is the Farrelly Brothers film from 1998. With Cameron Diaz and Ben Stiller. Very over-the-top, gross-out, kind of stoner comedy-ish humor. Pretty well-received at the time. It was a pretty big hit. I remember seeing it just the once in the theater, and I haven't seen it since. So I don't know if it holds up that well or not. What do you guys think? Is it possible that There's Something About Mary is funnier than Young Frankenstein?
No. No, it's not. I'm just going to say it. No. So Young Frankenstein is great. It's so much fun. It's one that I don't even love it as much as a lot of other people do. It's third or fourth Brooks for me. But it's still so good. It's so solid, and it manages to be entertaining even if you don't know a whole lot of the original story. It was interesting when I watched Bride of Frankenstein for the first time, just a couple of months ago. All of a sudden, recognizing things that were in Young Frankenstein that were funny there, but I didn't realize where they had come from. And so it still manages to make it interesting even if you don't know most of the origins. There's Something About Mary. It doesn't work for me, and it's not just the gross out comedy. It's the gross out comedy combined with this sort of half-hearted attempt to do a sweet romance. And the two of them don't really work together. For a romantic comedy to really work, you have to there has to be some level in which you're on board with your characters and want them to do well. And there's the characters, and There's Something About Mary are just so unpleasant. And the entire movie is spent making them look unpleasant. I just can't get on board with both halves. I might have responded to it slightly better if it had just flat out tried not to do anything sweet or charming and had just been gross. Because I feel like at least then I would have understood what it was trying to do. But because it was also trying to make me kind of at least a little bit care about the story, it lost me completely. So I'm 100% voting Young Frankenstein. I think it's more solid. I think it has smarter tone. And I think it's definitely one that is it's more, it's absolutely one that doesn't, there's something about Mary caters to a very specific kind of comedic taste, which is not necessarily right. anything wrong with it, but Young Frankenstein, I like that it is broad enough that it has a whole bunch of different kinds of jokes so that almost anybody can watch it and find something to enjoy.
Right. I mean, I think that the main problem with the Farrelly brothers is that Dumb and Dumber bought so many people's trust that they made a series of films afterwards which violated that trust in a number of ways. Like, you know, meaning the Farrelly brothers fans post Dumb and Dumber went into films like Something About Mary kind of already on their side. Like, we're like ready to like it.
Yeah.
And then over the years, we've had to admit to ourselves that there wasn't the dedication to a certain base level of comedy, like you're talking about, Hannah. Like the love story that takes place in Dumb and Dumber is, it's played for laughs. It's a it's a ludicrous love story. Whereas there's Something About Mary is trying to say something serious and specific about the nature of love, in kind of within the same comedy universe. And that's a shame. I mean, I don't think that that's necessarily possible. I think that as jokes, several of the jokes are very successful. But I think that the point they were trying to make is lost in the comedy, and the comedy they were trying to make gets lost in the point that they were trying to make.
Right.
Yeah. It's also a needlessly Byzantine plot. Like, it took me a couple times through it before I really understood about, like, Woogie being that guy. You know, Woogie was mentioned at the beginning. You know, like, you know, there's a number of like loopbacks that the film does. It doesn't seem like a loopback film where you would have to remember the offhand mention of a boyfriend within the first 5 minutes of the film in order to get the whole point of the plot. Like, it's a Usual Suspects plot that they've added a bunch of a bunch of fart jokes to it, which is
it's strange.
Bold. It's a bold choice.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I agree with all of that. I remember it feeling very convoluted, which you wouldn't expect this kind of comedy to be. It should be straightforward, and it should be, especially in a movie where there's an entire extended scene all about her hair, you know, the stuff in her hair, and then it just doesn't make any sense. Like, why would they have to kind of craft this sort of side story with this troubadour and like all this stuff that like doesn't really have anything to do with the main story at all. It just felt so weird and so
it's like they
disjointed.
Multiple half movies that they all kind of put together.
Yeah.
And we're like, well, we have some gross jokes and we have an idea for a charming rom-com and we have this complicated drama network of relationships. Let's put them all together. It'll work.
Yeah, I think Mel Brooks did a great job in Young Frankenstein. It's super solid. And like you said, the jokes are plentiful. So at least a handful of them are going to really land. But it's also just on a purely, visual homage to the original styles that you can tell that they put a lot of work into making it feel and look and act like those films. And it really comes off in the final product. So, in addition to the fact that there's lots of great humor in it, there's a lot of artistry on display as well. So,
love for the genre.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So Young Frankenstein is going to beat There's Something About Mary.
Yeah, I found a quote from Roger Ebert about There's Something About Mary.
Yeah.
He gave it 3 out of 4 stars. Stating, what a blessed relief is laughter. This is There's Something About Mary they're talking about. What a blessed relief is laughter. It flies in the face of manners, values, political correctness, and decorum. It exposes us for what we are, the only animal with a sense of humor. That is needlessly philosophical, Mr. Ebert. I don't think that you watched the movie correctly, sir.
He was feeling hungry that day when he wrote that one. All right, next up we have Ant-Man against 500 Days of Summer. So Ant-Man is the film in the Marvel Cinematic Universe from 2015, starring Paul Rudd as the titular Ant-Man. It was originally going to be an Edgar Wright movie, and then something happened and they disagreed on where the story was going, or something happened and he went off of it. So this is what we got. And it's fine. It's pretty fun and well executed, I guess. It's not nearly as large of a scope as some of the other films in the MCU, but I think it works decently well as a one-off. We're about to get the sequel here in a few short weeks, I think. And then 500 Days of Summer stars Joseph Gordon-Levitt and her name is going to escape me. It's
Zooey Deschanel.
Zooey. And it's a romantic drama. I can't remember the director. I think it's Mark Webb.
That's correct.
I think you're right. Wow. Yes.
The only reason I remember that is like that I remember he directed Spider-Man after he directed 500 Days of Summer, and his last name was Webb, and it was weird. So that was how my brain worked there. I remember liking 500 Days of Summer pretty well. It's kind of depressing and it doesn't really go the way you expect, but it is good and it's interesting. So one of these is fairly fluff and one of these is a little bit more speculative in terms of what the story is trying to tell you. So what do you think? Which one of these is the better movie?
Well, I would have to go with 500 Days of Summer here. I mean, I think that just structurally, it's the more ambitious film. I think that it's a rare film that is trying to be a love story without being a romantic comedy. I don't think 500 Days of Summer is by any means a comedy.
Right.
There's some jokes in it, but it's a romance. It's a kind of a pure exploration of love in a lighthearted context. And yes, there's powerful depression that ends up coming in the third act, but like it's still essentially about young love and about kind of a serious contemplation of it and not used as the engine for a bunch of jokes.
Right.
Which I'm very impressed by that. And it stuck with me longer than I really thought that it would have, and almost due entirely to the performances and to, like I said, the bold structure of it, where we kind of know going into it that it's finite, right? Like whenever he gets happy, it's finite, but that's true for all of us, right? Like there's always a ticking clock on however we feel right now. It's a very profound, way to approach a human life. I love Ant-Man too. I mean, Ant-Man, everything that you said about Ant-Man, I was going to say about Solo.
Like, I thought the same thing. I was like, that's not that dissimilar.
Exactly. This is the Solo of the MCU. Yeah. In other words, Doug loved it. Like, it's great because it's sort of effortless. Like there's no like big, heavy weight on it from franchise, right? Like it's able to kind of just sort of flex the muscles of the genre that it's in and of the characters, and it can make as many jokes as it wants and it doesn't feel like, you know, it's causing the story to bog down or anything. So it really hurts to vote against it. I've Ant-Man wins a lot of matchups for me, but I think 500 Days of Summer is, even though it did really well at the box office, it's kind of underappreciated as a really serious romance with really great actors.
Yeah, nobody really talks about it much anymore. It's definitely kind of just a forgotten movie.
Yeah, it's a shame. Yeah. Maybe because there's parentheses in the title.
That turns people off. I agree with all of that. I think I think Ant-Man is one of, if not the only MCU movie that's not weighed down by the rest of the franchise. It's the only one that seems to be free of the the deep storytelling chains that are like connecting everything else together. And I have no fear going to see Ant-Man and the Wasp that I'm going to have to like keep the entire world of MCU in mind, because right. that's not the kind of movie that that is. And that's refreshing in the MCU, which is getting more and more kind of bloated and tangled together. And so I really appreciate Ant-Man for being sort of the freer version of all that. I wish more of the MCU movies followed that pattern. I wish as well that I actually liked the movie itself more. I like what it did, but the story itself wasn't as fun to me as I wanted it to be. So I liked it, and I like it within the MCU as something different, as something that is more interesting to me in tone for a superhero movie. But like I would have to think really hard before remembering like any of the plot details.
Right.
500 Days of Summer, I think, is great. I think it's it makes some really, really interesting statements about love and about its about loss and about expectations. And it's much more creatively told. Ant-Man is great, but it's very straightforward. And I like that 500 Days of Summer kind of plays around with the story a little bit and goes in interesting directions and takes some bolder choices. And I think it's one that is several years older than Ant-Man, but I think lasts longer and will stick around longer and will be remembered longer, even though it seems to have been forgotten a little bit. But Ant-Man, I think, has been forgotten a little bit too, and that was only 3 years ago. So
right.
So yeah, I'm voting 500 Days of Summer, but I give kudos to Ant-Man for being willing to not get as weighed down by the rest of the MCU as some of the others have been.
I do wonder though if Edgar Wright had been given the free rein to do what he wanted to do, if it would have allowed Ant-Man to be even more on its own, like even more its own unique gem within the MCU, to where it's almost completely disconnected and really just its own solid movie of its own right. You know, like, because Edgar Wright, he when he makes a movie, he makes it his own. He's got a very yeah. strong directorial style, and it's just a shame. Like, you wonder
I would have loved to see his Ant-Man.
Yeah, you wonder what it would have been. I mean,
right, it would have been interesting, but then it would have been even more of a culture shock to see that character in Captain America: Civil War not being directed by Edgar Wright. Like, it would have been really weird. And I mean, regardless Maybe. Of sort of what the objective desirable outcome to all of that would have been, I think mm-hmm. that I can see why they released the film that they did, because mm-hmm. they need these Legos to fit together. The marketing yeah. team has decided that they really all need to fit together tonally at a certain level.
The one thing that I could say that might counter that would be, you know, you look at James Gunn and the Guardians films, like he's a very strong directorial style too. But then you look at those characters as they were portrayed in Infinity War and they're pretty similar. Like it doesn't feel like the characters changed much, although maybe they just didn't have as much time to.
Yeah, that's true. I have real problems with those characters in Infinity War, which we didn't get into in the episode. I think that that those characters were meant to subvert all of the rest of the characters that they were fighting alongside. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I think that was a terrible clash that happened. And I would have preferred a less original set of heroes that weren't intentionally trying to make fun of the heroes that we're supposed to take seriously. That's how I saw their presence in Infinity War. So yeah, no, you're not wrong that the James Gunn Galaxy films were like great and unique. And I think that it made them problematic features for me in Infinity War.
All right. So 500 Days of Summer is going to beat Ant-Man. Okay, next up we have The Dark Knight Rises up against Punch Drunk Love. So Dark Knight Rises is the final film in the Christopher Nolan Dark Knight Batman trilogy. with Tom Hardy as Bane, who sounds like he's talking through a grapefruit or something. and then we have Punch Drunk Love, which is Adam Sandler and Emily Watson, and directed by Paul Thomas Anderson. It's a really kind of bizarre family drama, and not at all like anything else Adam Sandler had done to date. It's one of his very few purely dramatic roles, that there really isn't any of the normal silly Sandler stuff in that at all. I think this is kind of a slam dunk for Punch Drunk Love. It's way more cinematic. It's a much more interesting movie. And I'm not even the biggest Paul Thomas Anderson fan, but I think this might be my favorite of his. It's probably a close toss up between this and There Will Be Blood. Dark Knight Rises did not impress me at all. I was pretty bored, mostly, which, you know, why would you want to be bored in a Batman movie? That doesn't sound like a good plan. What did you guys think? Were you also similarly bored, or did you find something fun in Dark Knight Rises?
Yeah, no, I mean, I found an ending, right? That's really all that I came to the theater for. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, let's like put a button on this. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a problem with a lot of modern trilogies, is that they make, so, and this happened in The Matrix, and this happened in the Star Wars prequels. This would have happened in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy trilogy, which never got made. Mm-hmm. Is that if the first one does good, and we're going to wait for it to really do good, and then we're going to just jam through the next two, you know? Mm-hmm. And so the problem here is that the second Dark Knight film was so good that there was nothing. It wasn't like they were going to take that momentum and like drive it somewhere. Like, no, like they had to kind of quickly get to the end of it, you know? And that's kind of how this film felt. I mean, I think that the Catwoman stuff was interesting, and the, Occupy Wall Street vibe was a kind of a surprising element that they brought into it. The Robin element was horrible fan service, and that, especially since he did nothing. He actually did not help. Mm-hmm. He hurt in a couple cases, which was a terrible waste of a character. There was a real opportunity for something for Robin to be incredibly pivotal to the plot, and I think there were a lot of moments and characters that kind of wound up that way. And it's just a shame. It's just the film was sort of the waste of a third of a trilogy in a lot of ways. But I had to vote for it because I didn't get Punch Drunk Love. I don't really understand what the point was. Like, I could get the point of each of the scenes, but the whole convoluted plot with the phone sex lines and the, what he finds, like the deal with the pudding, and there's like an organ that he finds outside. Like, it was a little bit, it got a little David Lynch for me, but without David Lynch's sense of subtlety and menace, you know, and it thought that it was being a normal romantic comedy film. And so it wasn't clear what role, you know, what hat I was supposed to put on as I was watching it. I found it, I guess what I'm trying to say is it felt emotionally disorganized. And I think that that's a lot of Paul Thomas Anderson films feel that way, even when they're made really well. Like the Master was like executed correctly, but it wasn't sure how it felt about itself, you know? And I think that, like, that can be a fun time at the movies, but it's going to hurt you on Flickchart. And I think that for all of its faults, Dark Knight Rises is a coherent film for the story that it's trying to tell.
It's interesting hearing you talk about Punch Drunk Love, because I remember liking it a lot. It's been a long time since I've seen it. I saw it back when I was really first getting into movies, very seriously. And one thing that I think helped me by accident is that in my early days of not recognizing film directors and not recognizing people's names, I briefly mixed up Paul Thomas Anderson and Wes Anderson. And so watching Punch Drunk Love through that lens makes total sense, thinking it's a Wes Anderson film, because it's got that sort of weird combination of like light quirkiness and but also like also being like maybe a little depressing, but also yeah. kind of funny. But like, it feels oddly enough like a Wes Anderson film. So it wasn't yeah. that far off me accidentally thinking this is who I was watching. And so if you ever need to, if you ever decide to rewatch it, think it's a Wes Anderson film when you watch it. But it's, but I liked Punch Drunk Love. It's the only thing I've ever liked Adam Sandler in. And it's the only one that, that, where he still brings a sense of childishness is not exactly the right word, but a sense of not being ready to be an adult in the real world. And, but instead of the movies, his comedies where that's played for either charm or laughter, here it's just tragic. And I get that. I can yeah. I can watch that and I can understand that and I can get behind him there instead of cheering him on. So I liked Punch Drunk Love. I don't know how I'd feel about it if I revisited it years later, but I remember liking it a lot at the time. Dark Knight Rises was all I can think is that they after Dark Knight came out, they thought, oh, okay, so Joker ended up being more interesting and more popular than Batman in the movie. Definitely that's going to happen with our third villain and our third villain's mm-hmm. movie. So we don't need to actually put Batman in the movie. We just need it. It's just going to be Bane. It's going to be and Catwoman and it's going to be awesome. And there's Batman doesn't do anything in this movie. And the villains, unlike the Joker and even unlike Two-Face in Dark Knight, are not compelling enough to carry this entire movie like right. they wrote them to try to be. And so it was all I remember is waiting for Batman to show up and do something. And it was a very long wait. And I didn't care about any of the other people because they weren't like I liked what they were trying to do with it, but it never was compelling enough to work for me. And the characters were never nuanced enough or flexible enough or subtle enough to work for me. They were all a little caricatured, and that's not what made the Joker interesting. Was Heath Ledger gave this very this layered performance, which was really interesting. And so right. you could watch and peel back the layers mentally as you watch, and you can't do that with any of these characters. And so it fell really, really flat for me. And even though I absolutely get Punch Drunk Love not tonally sitting well with other people, I definitely have to vote for it here for myself.
I remember the one thing that really got me in Dark Knight Rises was the ending, like just being just like, really, this is how you're going to end your movie, where they're just like sitting in a cafe and they just kind of knowingly give themselves a little wink and a nod. It's just like, come on, this is dumb. This is really dumb. There's some sequences in Punch Drunk Love that really stick out in my mind. Like there's this crazy car accident in the beginning of the movie that I remember being just like completely out of nowhere. You have no idea it's coming, and it affects Adam Sandler in the movie almost the same way it affects the audience, which is really cool. And then like all this stuff with Philip Seymour Hoffman, where he's just yelling and screaming and mm-hmm. just like getting like belligerent. It's like so intense. And just like the choices of sets, like where stuff was happening, it was so unusual. Like some stuff was in a grocery store, some stuff was like in this weird like department store, and then like some of the stuff is like at their house with all the sisters, and it's so weird and I don't know. Maybe it's supposed to make you feel uneasy from the very beginning, like it's supposed to throw you off kilter, like you're saying that it doesn't feel like it knows what it is or knows what it's trying to say from a tone perspective. But maybe that's the mm-hmm. whole point, that it's supposed to be kind of mimicking his psyche, like he doesn't really know how he fits in, and it's just all scattered. So that, to me, it totally worked. Like I think the whole movie gels in that way. And I really enjoyed it. Punch Drunk Love is going to beat Dark Knight Rises. So next up we have Sweeney Todd, the Demon Barber of Fleet Street from 2007 up against Despicable Me from 2010. So Sweeney Todd is the Tim Burton, Johnny Depp, Helena Bonham Carter film version of the stage musical. And Despicable Me is the animated DreamWorks film with Steve Carell as Gru, the arch enemy nemesis of he's a supervillain, and he's got these little minions who have turned out to be an insane amount of I don't know
taking
how
taking over the world.
I don't know how minions became popular. I really don't. Like that, I guess they're small and cute and don't speak English. But that, you know, is that really all it takes for something to be a cultural milestone? I don't know. It's crazy. Like if you go to Universal Studios, they are everywhere. Like people have, you know, the shirts and they have the hats and they have all kinds of stuff. Mm-hmm. They're like probably second only to Harry Potter in terms of brand loyalty. Among Universal stuff, which is insane. Despicable Me is fine. You know, it's a decent kids movie, but it doesn't transcend. It doesn't have like the bigger sort of underpinnings like a lot of Pixar does. So it's serviceable. You know, all of the Despicable Me movies are just fine. You know, they're not anything great. Sweeney Todd, I also thought was just okay. I've never seen the stage musical, so I don't have that to compare it to say that, you know, it's has to live up to whatever the musical did or but you know, it's pretty interesting. It's an interesting story, and I think Johnny Depp does an okay job singing, but it's I don't know, I could take it or leave it. It's not one of my favorite Tim Burton movies. What do you say, Hannah? You're the musical expert here. What do you think of Sweeney Todd?
I really like Sweeney Todd. I like the show as well, and the movie does a really good job of taking the show and making it a lot more accessible to a wider audience. The stage show is a little bit more in the style of is a little bit more operatic and a little bit more less easy to like get into. But I think the movie does a really good job with it. I think it simplifies it a little bit, and I think the people who they all their cast is pretty solid. None of them are like phenomenal singers,
right.
but these are more heavily acted songs anyway. They're often less melodic and more about the words and the emotions and thoughts behind them. So it works pretty well.
It's like the talk singing style.
Yeah. Yeah. And you can get away with that with Sondheim songs, which are very, very heavily focused on the lyrics. And you can do that a little more. A lot of the people who have interpreted his stuff have not necessarily been known as phenomenal singers. And so I think it works here. And I think it's good. I think Tim Burton's a good match for this, has that sort of over the top campy darkness that I think is actually right. A really good fit for the story. Despicable Me, I don't care about. It's the original one, like, has a little bit of a fun idea, but it came out the same time as Megamind, which I thought was so much more interesting and played with the supervillain story in a way where the fact that he was a supervillain actually mattered. Despicable Me was just a story about an unusual parent with supervillain. Like a supervillain skin slapped on top of it.
Right.
And none of that played into it at all. And so I found it very disappointing. Although I love the title song that Pharrell did. That's so much fun. So Despicable Me is not, I don't understand why it became like the thing. I don't understand why Minions took over the world either. But I would rather have had Sweeney Todd take over the world in terms of pop culture references. So I'm voting Sweeney Todd for sure.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I mean, there's the Universal Animation is right around Sony Pictures Animation in my personal ranking of like animation studios that just aren't funny. Like they think they're a lot funnier than they are. Now maybe they're funny to children, and this is one of those situations where like I want children to have things that are just for them that I'm actually not supposed to like find things funny in it. I don't want them to necessarily have to put in adult service into films in order to keep me engaged. If you want to have a film that's like 100% only kids get it, like that's fine. So it's not like I resent Despicable Me, but it certainly doesn't do well in my chart. I think that it falls into the same problem that a lot of modern children's movies have, especially that DreamWorks film Home, where the third act is just noise. It just sort of decides to really have a lot of things happening and things flashing on the screen for the last 25 minutes. And that's how they achieve their denouement. And like, it's a really lazy, it's lazy storytelling is how is sort of the net result of it. I don't think that, go ahead.
I was going to say, I will never understand either. This has happened a couple of times where I watch a movie that is clearly catered to children. I do not think Despicable Me was necessarily trying to reach to adults. But the story is about someone accepting parenthood.
Right.
Like,
right,
exactly. That's not about children. That's not something, if you're making a movie for children, make a movie that like make it about that from the kid's perspective. And it really never is. Its message is targeting adults while its humor is targeting children. And it's a weird mix. And it doesn't work.
Yeah,
for me.
I think a lot of more modern animated movies are kind of like that, though. There are very few stories at all, really, where the main crux of the plot is told from the children's point of view, like animated or not animated. Like that's a very rare thing now for whatever reason. I don't know if Hollywood just doesn't want to tell stories of that ilk or if the culture has changed somewhat. Like Stranger Things is I think popular because it's one of the only stories that seems to do this.
Well, there's the Lorax.
I think you can do that in a way that has it still relatable to kids. I think you can do something like think back to one of my favorites, looking at like Beauty and the Beast, which is not about children, but the fundamental message of that is friendship with people who seem different from you. And that's right. Still a relatable message. But the central message of Despicable Me is the importance of accepting parenthood responsibility. And that's a message that just like there's no level on which that's going to be. Children being like, oh, yes, I needed to hear that message. So like there's ways of telling stories with adult characters who are able to have maybe in narratively a little bit more agency and still making it a lesson that can be proportionally given brought down to kids. I don't think Despicable Me does that. And I think that's why the Minions are the ones that I caught on instead of Gru or even the children in that movie, because the Minions are relatable in some way to kids.
Yeah. Over the course of the three Despicable Me movies, which I have seen all of because I have children, the kind of overall story that's being told is Gru, you know, becoming a father, and then Gru finding a suitable mother for his children, you know, to be with him. And then the third film is sort of like how to balance his own internal desires with the fact that he is now tied down to a significant other. So it's very much like, you know, almost all sort of from the Gru perspective, no matter which movie you're watching. So it is, I guess, unusual in that regard. Like you said, that you would expect that more of the story would be from the kid's point of view, but yeah, they're just sort of there for the ride a little bit.
I mean, the real shame is that they had a real opportunity to make a universally enjoyable film about deep topics the way that they did with essentially all three of the Toy Story films, where the Toy Story films told deep, hilarious stories for everybody. And you know, I think that the points they were making about parenthood need to be made. Like that, you know, I think that they're valid. It's a valid theme for us to meditate on as a culture. But you know, you kind of need to do it better.
I think they want to be Pixar and to be telling these stories. Pixar can get away with having the Incredibles and with right, having a story right. that's about parenthood and family, because the story as a whole is entertaining enough and actually says really good stuff of value to the adults. And so I think they're trying to do that. I think they're trying to reach that level of telling stories simultaneously for both, but not right. realizing that it's not really hitting on that level.
Yeah. And as parents, we should be thankful, right, that they're trying to reach us too while we're stuck there in the theater with our offspring.
And maybe it'll stick someday. Maybe they'll figure out the formula they need.
And sometimes they totally nail it. Like I think you know, Inside Out obviously is a great example of a mm-hmm. movie that it totally works no matter how old you are. I really liked Sing. Which was I think it's a Blue yeah. Sky animation
yeah,
movie.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah.
I didn't get to see that one, but I heard good things about it.
You would love it. It's really good.
And that's an interesting example of the third act where everything slows down.
Yes. Yes.
They make the very brave choice to, you think that the film is going to end on a sad note, and then everything just gets really still and serious mm-hmm. and profound in the third mm-hmm. act.
Yeah, that movie really impressed me by how it defied expectations. But anyway, we're getting off on a tangent. So Sweeney Todd is going to beat down
the whole podcast is a tangent.
It's going to beat down Steve Carell in Despicable Me.
How'd you guys let me beat you on that one? Come on. There's no liars in this game, just players.
The seat taken?
Nobody's in the seat that I ain't taking, friend.
So this is Sabak?
Sabak.
Got it.
You played before? A
couple times, yeah.
Captain Lindo Calrissian.
Han Solo.
Looks like you're having a good day.
I'm a lucky guy.
Can I ask you a question, Captain Calrissian?
Anything, Han.
It's Han, but that's okay.
All right, so it's now time for the title fight. And we're talking about Solo, A Star Wars Story, which is the dumbest log line. They should have just called it Solo. I mean, if we got Rogue One, we don't need to call it Rogue One, A Star Wars Story, do we?
Well, you got to smear the branding feces all over it in order to mark your territory.
So I'm by far probably the biggest Star Wars nerd among the three of us. So I'm going to go last, and I'm going to let you guys start off with what you thought of Solo.
I thought it was a nice little piece of fan fiction, but it was completely unnecessary and added nothing to the grand scheme of things.
Right.
Rogue One, which I didn't love, but Rogue One was like attempting to flesh out these stories. Solo, I really don't think does. It was like the epitome movie that I go and I have a decent time with, because it's enjoyable. It's got some pretty terribly cheesy dialogue, but it's enjoyable enough. And Alden, what's his face, is enjoyable enough. And Donald Glover is always great. So it was fun, but like the instant I left the theater, I was like, well, I'm not going to remember that tomorrow. And right. it doesn't enhance the character in any way. And Han Solo is one of my favorite characters in the Star Wars universe. Han Solo was my first crush when I was 9 years old. And so like I love this character, and I was hoping to love the movie, and it was just kind of there. And there were so many like little tiny moments of them trying to be like nudging the fans and being like, huh, you see what we did there? You see that we added something that was mentioned right. in a later movie. and it just got old. And so like, I had a good time, but I had to kind of turn off connecting it to anything. And it is the definition of a popcorn movie for me, where I watch it. I'm fine with it. I wasn't mad or sad during the show and then or anything. And then I left and was like, well, that never needed to happen. There was that adds nothing.
Yeah. It's very much a prototypical Ron Howard movie.
It landed like very, very like 54% or something on my chart. I think it was just slightly above the middle.
Right.
I guess that makes sense. I mean, I think all those same justifications make me kind of like it. You know, the I was, and Nathan, fill me in on this. That there was the Lord Miller directing team was going to do it, and then
right,
and then Howard came in and like reshot everything. Is that what happened?
Right. Yeah. Lord Miller had a very specific style of putting things together, and they were very slow, and they were not used to how Lucasfilm makes movies, and basically they were running way behind, and they're doing just mostly improv, like hardly sticking to the script. And Kathleen Kennedy was just like, guys, you can't do it this way. This is not how Star Wars movies are made. You either got to do it the right way or we got to get somebody else. And they said, well, you got to get somebody else. So they got Ron Howard.
I mean, I'm on record as being lukewarm on Ron Howard. The quote from my dad is that like whenever he watches what Ron Howard film, he feels like he's watching a coloring book where it's very clear how you're supposed to like be feeling in any moment. And that's true a little bit in this film. But like when I look at what Lord Miller are capable of, so Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, the Jump Street movies, the Lego Batman movie, Lego Ninjago, like these are films that have a harsh, subversive cynicism to them that right. makes them funny. And I don't think that there's any room for that in Star Wars. You know, I think right. that if they had followed through with what I'm sure was in their brain, this would have felt like a parody. It would have felt like, look how ridiculous we're making Lando. Like Lando is like so suave that it becomes a joke that he's so suave.
Yeah.
And that's not the spirit of the game that we're playing. I think that the Ron Howard approach here was the as he always does, fundamentally uncynical. It was the more gentle, child friendly approach to the material, and it's a children's movie the way that I remember them from my childhood. Where there was a spine to it. There was, there was some guts to the action. But it was still for children. Like it was still a children's movie in its in the simplicity of the moral universe and of the good guys and bad guys. And there wasn't anything dirty. Okay, there's one penis joke, but like there wasn't anything like super dirty in it. And like that was so refreshing. Like I just felt really happy and innocently happy at the end of the film. So I think it's going to win some fights for me.
Well, I took my whole family to see it. So my daughter's 7, my son's 9, and I asked my daughter after the movie was over, what was your favorite part? And she's like, I don't really remember anything. I don't really remember anything in the movie. And I said, well, that's probably telling, because it feels so just bland. And it's a combination of a lot of things for me. It's number one, I could never get over Alden being, trying to do his own version of Han Solo that never felt right. Like it never felt at all like Harrison Ford. And, I don't know if that's to his credit or if that's, something that he just never could do. It just never felt like the character to me, not once. The only stuff that I really liked in it was anytime they were inside the Millennium Falcon, that whole stuff, all of that stuff was fine and it was fun. And, but like the train heist stuff, I was bored and I didn't understand why people were dying when they didn't have to. And basically nothing happened. Like they did all this stuff and people died so they could get this stuff. And then they had to drop it and it exploded in a mountain. It's just like, what? It doesn't make any sense from a plot perspective.
And then
it's
the
like,
people that killed them turned out to be good guys. That
yeah.
We have sympathy for.
Right. So it's like the whole thing is just a convoluted mess of nothing. And the other thing that I that I think is weird is that so many people are like, well, Alden made Han Solo his own. And then they flip over and they say, but Donald Glover did a fantastic job too as Lando. And he's doing an absolute impression of Billy Dee Williams. He's not even trying to do his own thing at all. He's doing Billy Dee Williams doing Lando all the time. And you can't have it both ways. You know, you can't be hypocritical and say that both approaches are the right way to go. They should have gotten a guy that could mimic Harrison Ford, and that would have worked so much better. And they didn't, and it ruined the movie. And then they also picked the most generic, boring female role too. Both in the character and both in the actress choice, and like what she does in the movie is just like, she is not interesting at all. You don't believe that he cares for her at all. There's no chemistry at all. It's just like, there's so many things that they just dropped the ball on. And it, I don't know if it's the script or it's the direction or it's the cast or all three, but it just didn't work. And it's, as I'm thinking more and more about it, as I've seen it, it just keeps going farther and farther down in my, my admiration for it. It's like, and it's not even like nitpicky Star Wars nerd stuff, like where they got like stuff wrong from a lore perspective. It's just purely on a baseline movie level that I just don't think it works. So I was really disappointed.
I was reading a thing. I don't remember where I found it, but they were talking about how one of the problems with Solo is that when we meet Han in the original trilogy, he has a character arc from there. He starts off as a cynical loner. Mm-hmm. And so this Star Wars story is going to have to end with him being a cynical loner.
Right.
And he starts off the movie surprisingly like optimistic and open to other people and like collaborative. And so you watch it and it's either going to have to end really, really badly for him to be where he is at the beginning of A New Hope, or it's going to have to end somewhat happily and it's going to feel off. Like there's not a good arc for him to have if you want to tell a happy story or a positive feeling story. And I think for me, that was part of why it didn't feel like Han to me, because he was doing a character arc that didn't match with where we saw him just not that much later. And it felt, I felt like I was watching somebody else's story, because it didn't, that's part of what it felt like, that didn't contribute to the story for me. It did not inform who Han was in A New Hope. It felt like an entirely different story that had nothing to do with the characters I knew.
Right. All right. So, Solo. Let's see how it goes up against the rest of the charts. So, first movie it goes up against is no slouch, Seven Samurai. Kurosawa's gigantic film.
That's a rough first film for it to go up against.
one of many that of Kurosawa's films that originally influenced George Lucas to make Star Wars in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the characters in Star Wars they're Ronin, right? Like they've sort of been abandoned by their masters, and they have to fight for the right thing, even though they sort of disconnected from society. I mean, I think it's a valid comparison to make. Mm-hmm. I mean, people would want, I think what people would have wanted, if they had wanted Solo at all, would have been a more of a samurai story, more of a Ronin story than the one that we got, which is A New Hope light. And that's a shame. I'm obviously choosing Seventh Samurai. It's one of my all-time favorite
films.
As am
I.
Yeah. We really needed something to make Han Solo become the sort of bitter man that he is. And nothing in the movie does that. Like, not really.
Well, see, I mean, I've never seen Han Solo as bitter. I've seen him as being not Luke. He just needs to be 5% less optimistic than Luke in order for the original trilogy to kind of find that comedic. And again, it's comedic tension. They only have like one actual fight on Hoth, right? Like it's not, it's, they're never, it's never like driving, you know, that there's not like a huge rift, you know, in their sentences. Like he's just a little bit more cynical. He just likes money a little bit more. I didn't see that. I don't think that Han Solo ever was or needs to be like some freaking Nick Nolte who was going to play him at one point.
No.
Some like Nick Nolte, you know, grizzled, like horrible veteran of the Clone Wars or whatever.
Right.
I think he's fine. It's fine. These guys.
Home Alone 2 is the next challenger for Solo.
I haven't seen Home Alone 2, so I can't vote here. I would vote Solo over Home Alone 1.
I think Home Alone 2 is okay. You know, it's even more water thin than the first one. I think even more improbable, but there are some really, really solid slapstick moments that happen. It's definitely not a better film than Solo.
All right. Yeah, I have not seen Home Alone 2 either. So
nice.
Doug is the sole decision maker.
Doug stands alone.
I need to watch Home Alone 2 so I can vote sometime.
Now it's up against Magnolia. Solo will beat Magnolia. We found an even more disappointing movie.
I don't know. These are so very different.
Yes.
Yeah, we should just end the podcast right here.
Podcast canceled. We found the matchup that breaks us. I'm gonna vote Magnolia because I remember Magnolia and I saw it so much earlier than Solo, and I saw Solo like 2 weeks ago and I don't remember it. So I think they both have some problems and they both have some good things, but Magnolia was clearly more memorable. So I'm voting that, I guess.
Yeah, no, I can't agree. I mean, I definitely remember Magnolia more than Solo. I mean, that's a hilarious and incredibly accurate metric to apply to a number of films. But like, I think Magnolia is more useful as a textbook of filmmaking and of acting than as of a movie. Which it's not. It's not like a film, a coherent story that it's trying to tell us. Right. It's a piece together and anthology piece, almost like an art project. And when I go to the movies, I want to see something a little more towards the Solo side of that spectrum.
So Solo's going to beat Magnolia?
Yes, sir.
Yes. Oh, that makes me feel so good. Now Solo is up against Sweeney Todd.
Which I love. It's in my top 100. Solo is not in my top 100, so Sweeney Todd's gonna win for me.
Doug?
Yeah, jeez. you go next, Nathan.
I guess Sweeney Todd. I wasn't disappointed in Sweeney Todd. I was a little bit maybe underwhelmed. But I wasn't quite as negatively affected, I guess. So I think I'd go Sweeney Todd here.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'll go with that. Yeah. I mean, I was disappointed by Sweeney Todd at certain points. I think that it's in many ways it was an unnecessary film. It was one of those films that we all always knew existed in some parallel universe. Like it was one of those films like I assumed Tim Burton would make it one someday.
Right,
like,
right.
It's so obvious.
It's an inevitable movie. Film.
Yeah. And like, you know, I don't think that the material, I think that an inevitable film is in some ways not what the material deserves. Right. Like it was a kind of a as expected telling of the story and the use of the music. And it would have been interesting to see something. I don't know, see something different. Maybe with actual singers, you know, something like that. Mm-hmm. But it is definitely more profound than Solo. So I'll go with that.
All right. Now Solo is up against Evan Almighty.
I'm out. Sorry.
Which is the Bruce Almighty sequel with Steve Carell in the main title role.
Evan Almighty is terrible. Like, yeah. I like Bruce Almighty okay. I enjoy pieces of it, but Evan Almighty is just a mess from beginning to end. And I didn't love Solo, but it was by far a more enjoyable watch than Evan Almighty.
Yep.
Evan Almighty was the Santa Claus, but he was Noah.
Right. All right. Solo wins that. So now Solo's up against Insomnia, the forgettable Christopher Nolan thriller.
Yeah, I mean, it's both forgettable and no fun. So you should be one or the other.
There's a little bit of fun in Solo, at least.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Yeah, that's got my vote.
Yeah, I'm definitely voting Solo here. I forgot them both, but Solo was more fun while I watched it.
I think the Kessel Run stuff, like that whole part of the movie, was worth the price of admission.
Pretty good.
Yeah.
Pretty good. Space Octopus.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. My Fair Lady, next up.
Hmm.
I'm voting My Fair Lady. I like Solo enough, but not enough to win me over a musical that I really love.
Yes, I agree. Again, it's more profound about what it's the points it maybe is sort of trying to make.
It also won 8 Oscars.
Yeah, let's not ignore that.
Okay. Next up, we've got Solo up against Glory, which we've just talked about recently.
I think this is mainly like attenuation over time on my part, but I don't have a very high opinion of Glory, as we've said. I think I'm going to vote Solo here, but like, let's go ahead and blame time for that. And I promise to rewatch Glory soon.
Yeah, it was fine. These are both ho-hum, so you got to just take whichever one is less ho-hum.
I'm going to give the nod to Solo here, but I really just don't care. So
there you go. Solo beats Glory.
Hannah into apathism. Yeah, I love it.
More on that train. We got JFK against Solo.
Well, Solo's more fun than JFK. Solo does not feel like it's 9 hours long.
Right.
So it's Solo is a much more fun ride. And JFK should have been so much more fun. It should have been a really enjoyable watch, and it just wasn't.
Yeah, I mean, but part of me wants to vote for JFK because it's fun in kind of the same way. Like, if you forget that an actual human being was killed, then the plot that they're telling in JFK, is like kind of exciting. Like, wow, all these different plots coming together. But yeah, it's not told very, very well, and that's not very economical. So yeah, we're going Solo.
If JFK had told that same story, but in like 2 hours instead of like 3.5, I think it would have liked it a whole lot more. With puppets.
All right. So Solo is 320 on our chart out of 560. So that seems about right.
It's higher than I thought it would be.
It's in the it's in the Evil Dead 2, Spy Kids, Despicable Me, Dark Knight Rises territory.
It's right below a whole bunch of movies that we talked about in our podcast today. Like, there's like 5 of them in a row right above Solo.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's a wrap for this episode of Flick Fights. But you can follow our chart's progress and see what else is hanging out around Solo by finding us as Flick Fights on Flickchart. And you can follow us on Twitter at FlickFights and find us on Facebook. And if you want to be a future guest and chat about movies with us, just send us an email to flickfights@flickchart.com. And from all of us at FlickFights, thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you soon.